accession number 27185, reel 35.
Major Barras, reel 35. You were saying that you were advised to keep clear of the university and the college in Calcutta.
Yes. I think that there were a lot of, I don't say they were all, but there was an element there which was a little bit hot-headed and come out and demonstrate on the streets, I suppose. But I never saw them. I never saw any demonstrations, so I never went round there, obviously. But by and large, I mean, they were very polite and very helpful, when the ones I ever met. We used, as I say, travel around in rickshaws a lot of the time. Sometimes there were big taxis there, all driven by Sikhs, mostly. Open taxis with a sort of hood which was put over the top. And they had these bulbous horns. You know, where you have a sort of a big sort of thing, looks like a rubber balloon, and you press it. And all the wind goes down a long pipe and comes out the other end like a sort of ship's siren. And you could hear these all over Calcutta as these Sikhs drove around. But we used to go from a taxi sometimes. It depended where you were going. One thing I just occurred to me, I forgot to tell you, that the railway between Colombo and Kandy was a toy railway. It wound its way up in the mountains, because Kandy was about 4,000 feet up, and then it went through to Euralia, where the tea plantations are. And I remember going up, it was fascinating. It wound its way round and round and round the mountains with a little engine and big windows you could look out of, and a sort of table there. And now and again, they bring you a plate of eggs. I just remember that both ways. I don't know what got in. I don't know how it was. As I think I said before, I think the first Europeans out there just asked for eggs, and ever since then they've got them.
Probably thought the eggs were the safest thing.
That's true, yes.
They're all enclosed.
That's right, yeah. Mm. Yes, I hadn't thought about that. But in Calcutta, I used to go around the Chowringhee, which was the main shopping centre. And of course, there were cows walking around because they were sacred. And on one occasion, I was looking into a shop window. I looked to my left, and there was a cow also looking in the window beside me. But of course, you couldn't. It was absolute sin to do anything to a cow in those days. I don't know whether they're still allowed to wander around. So eventually, the other thing I remember there was the prisoners of war coming home from the Japanese. We got the best of them, obviously, because the others, who were quite incapable of standing up or getting themselves organized, had been shipped straight back by air, ambulance or ship or whatever, hospital ship probably. But we got a number of them, came through Calcutta, and I must say they looked very gaunt, bent and underfed, but they were so cheerful. They were remarkably cheerful, considering what they'd been through. My guess is that most of them would have gone home and recovered completely and led proper lives. Funnily enough, the girl to whom I was given an introduction by letter actually married one of them. I had no inclination. We had no inclination to marry each other at all. We were just friends, but with a whole lot of others. But it was very, very sad to see them. But it was good to see that they had been released. I didn't get the chance to talk to them. I remember I did talk to one or two of them, but I didn't talk about that. I didn't ask them anything about what they'd been through. I mean, they just didn't want to talk about it.
Did you see anything of any enemies, POWs?
Oh, yes, plenty when I got to Burma. Oh, yeah. I'll tell you about those when we get to the right spot. Anyway, one day I was told, after I'd reporting to the Grand Hotel, that, there's a berth for you on, I think it's the Derbyshire, they said, British Indian line, which had been chartered, obviously, for trooping. I remember I went round to the docks, and I was directed, I remember wandering around looking for this ship. Anyway, I eventually found it. And it was 4 days, I think, to 4 days trip down to Rangoon. The only thing I can remember of the trip was looking out and seeing the flying fish, which broke out from the bow wave. And you could see them flying across just about 2 or 3 feet above the water for about 100 yards or so, and then plop back again. And that made me think about Kipling's The Road to Mandalay, where the flying fishes play. And I think that's what he meant, the troop ship.
Not the road.
Nothing to do with going up the road and seeing flying fishes, unless you were particularly drunk. And it occurred to me that's what he meant, the troop ship. Where the flying fishes play. I'd never seen it before. It was a remarkable sight, actually. Anyway, eventually we docked in Rangoon, which, of course, had already been, well, several months before, had been taken over by the British. I think it was a Mosquito aircraft went into Mangaldoon airfield there, was the first to arrive. About the 1st of May, I think it was.
What sort of condition was it in when you went through it?
Well, the town?
Yes.
It was run down, but it wasn't hadn't been bombed or destroyed, I don't think. There was one hotel called the Strand Hotel, which was still operating. That was on the front, on the sort of harbour front. There were a lot of houses there, European houses, which had been taken over by the army, or their services, say. And Burma Command Headquarters, which was 14th Army, which was the old 14th Army, were by then, I think, in Judson's College. Now, Judson's College was a local university or senior college, I can't remember. But I was put into the Royal Signals mess there temporarily. The only thing I can remember about that is I was introduced to Mariner's Gin, which is made in India. And not like the ancient mariner who stop is one and three. This could stop everybody. It was really lethal, and I didn't realise this.
And it was overproof, if it was a naval gin.
Yes. And I didn't realise this, and nobody told me about it. And I don't suppose they ever told anybody, because they just sort of sniggered behind their hands whilst one was drinking the stuff. And the only time in my life I've been felt incapable after I finished. I'd never really been drunk to the point, I mean, I've been merry and so forth, but I've never been drunk. I've always had my faculties, and never again. But I found on this occasion, I got myself upstairs to the room where I had a camp bed, one of those low ones, not the old wooden one, but one of those we put the legs on underneath, with a mosquito net, in the middle of a bare room. I found my way here, and I spent hours. It was like trying to get into a rowing boat in a storm, as far as I was
getting into bed.
Yes. It was murder. I never had mariner's gin after that.
Who had actually given you this poisonous stuff?
Well, in the Royal Signals mess there, I suppose. But I don't think they thought about it. They probably didn't do it deliberately, I don't think. They were used to it themselves. And I may have been, you know, it may have been a bottle on the side, help yourself. So I may have put in what I thought was normal sort of Gordon's gin tipple. Anyway, taught me a lesson about the local gin, and also the terrible Victory cigarettes, which were also made in India. It tasted like they were Cairo stable floor sweepings, I think was what everybody said they were made up of. So anyway, I was there for about, I don't know, probably not very long, 2 or 3 days, waiting to go to Tonggu, where my headquarters, 19th Indian Division, was stationed, which was 150 miles north of Rangoon. The usual way of travelling there was by jeep up dusty road, straight road, ran for 150 miles through various little villages and towns. And during the monsoon time, of course, it was very muddy and slushy. Now, this must have been, I must now be in October, I think, of 1946. be, wouldn't it?
45.
We're still in 45, are we?
I think so, yes.
Oh, yes, we are. Yes. We're quite right. Mm. Still in 1945. And the monsoon was coming to its end then. So I think I do remember going up this dusty road and getting the other end, being covered in the stuff and looking like a local. I mean, really.
Who drove you? Did you drive yourself all the...
Oh, no, I didn't drive myself. I was driven up by somebody else. I don't know whether the Jeep... it was really a question of waiting till somebody was going up there.
So you were hitching a lift?
Hitching a lift, yeah. So eventually I reached up in Tonggu. It was a little village on the Sitang River. And headquarters, 19th Indian Division, was situated round the Maidan, which was a sort of big grass area, where I suppose the old Saabs used to play cricket, because my office was in what must have been the pavilion, or at least a games shed of some sort. Quite big, actually. It's a wooden structure. And then there were the European houses round the Maidan, which was quite long. It was must have been several hundred yards long and wide, because we used to take off a little aircraft there. And the general had his office across the other side. And general staff, so to speak, there was a G2 ops there who was an Indian. Gulmawaz Khan was his name. He was Baluchi, very nice chap. He'd just finished staff college at Delhi, I think. And so we had our offices there with our staff. Most of our staff were Indian, or Anglo-Indians. A lot of the clerks were Anglo-Indians.
Was this because of a deliberate policy of Indianizing the...
Well, no, it was... What do you mean, him being...
yes, having so many Indian officers on the staff.
I suppose so, yes. But he was a major already, so he must have been commissioned some time back.
Well, this was in the transition, really, to independence.
Well, not really. It hadn't started then. No. It wasn't thought about. I mean, people knew it was coming.
Yes.
But it wasn't a, upfront, so to speak, so much then.
What were your duties then as GSO2 INT?
Well, it was really a wartime appointment. And I grabbed at it because it was going to get me out there, but it was obviously a job which wasn't going to tax me. You know, in wartime, you'd be providing all the information about the enemy and your own troops and so forth for the general, and giving him appreciations, collecting all the sit reps and everything one did on brigade and at a higher level. But now, of course, none of that was going on. The only information I could collect together and collate was what was going on in the various parts of the Southeast Asia which had been liberated. I mean, for instance, there was a division, Indian division in Indonesia. The Malaya had been liberated. There was an operation set up to take Malaya called Zipper, which was going to be launched from India across the bay, so to speak, to straight to Malaya, but that didn't come off in the end. They just gave in. So they were able to occupy it. So there were mostly Indian divisions everywhere, because there was only one British division out there, actually, the 2nd Infantry Division. That was the only one in the whole of 14th Army, and two East African, yeah.
22nd and 23rd, I think.
Is it 20 or 80? I can't remember. I know it had 2 and 3 on the end. So every day, I mean, a lot of these places were still in a bit of turmoil. There were Japanese prisoners wandering around who hadn't heard about the surrender had been agreed.
They presumably they were stragglers rather than prisoners.
Well, they became prisoners.
Became prisoners.
Then there were the local gangs, guerrillas, who had been operating against the Japanese in various places, and had armed themselves off the Japanese dumps, and which were now unguarded. And there was this movement towards independence, which they weren't the people who anybody, let alone the local inhabitants, wanted to be governed by, but they were causing a bit of trouble. Not a lot, But there was a problem, quite a lot of problems in Indonesia because they didn't want the Dutch back there. So a lot of these reports used to come in about the situations in all these various places.
And they'd be coming down presumably from Kaur and beyond Kaur, would they, to your...
I don't know where they came from. No, there wasn't a corps then, I don't think. There was just the army and there was Burma Command, so I presume they must have come through Burma Command.
There's Burma Command and then there were the divisions on the ground.
Oh, yes, there were still a lot of divisions. I mean, there was a 17th Indian at Maktila, there was another one at Mandalay, and then both the African, and then there was the British division. Yeah. And these reports used to come in, and every morning the general was... General Pete Rees. He was called Pete Rees by everybody. A little chap, little Welshman, with a terrific personality, great fighting spirit. And he used to hold his prayers every morning. And I had to get up with all his reports and the big map there of Southeast Asia and with a stick just point out what had been going on. And some of the names of these places which... where there had been an incident, were totally incomprehensible to pronounce. Anyway, I used to stagger through them, sort of come out the other end, bloodied but unbowed. And Pete used to stand there, Bruce used to stand at the side there with a sort of grin on his face. When I came out the other end, he'd say, "Well done." But he was a great character. He'd come on the phone. I mean, normally, when you've got a general coming through to you, you usually get the ADC first, and say the general would like to speak to you, and you get some indication as to what he was going to ask you, so you've got some idea in your head what was going to happen. But he used to come straight through sometimes, and you'd fit up the phone, "Rees here, who is that?" And if you didn't know your general's name, you say, "Who the hell are you?" You know, and it did happen on one or two occasions, and Jack just got blasted off the other end, didn't you? You'd know your general... Your general in command of the division. And the other thing I'd had to do was to, on two or three occasions, I had to go and interview Burmese with an interpreter to get some information about where the Japanese had treated them.
Just gathering evidence.
Gathering evidence, yes. Mm-hmm. Which was a bit harrowing at times. Mm. But the point is that when you went and spoke to, I can't remember who they were. They were obviously people who the Japanese considered were plotting against them or doing something that wasn't to the Japanese advantage. But when they were describing what happened to them, whether they were having the bottoms of their feet hit with bamboos or water dripped on their heads or being heads plunged into a bath of water or whatever, they would tell you and laugh the whole time. And then that's the Asiatic, Oriental way of doing things. And I found it very difficult because I didn't... First of all, when I found this guy was sort of laughing away having something terrible happen to him, I didn't know whether to sympathise with him and laugh as well or whether to behave as I normally would. And I came to the conclusion they would expect me not to do what they did, but to behave naturally and normally. So I didn't join in the laughter. I just kept a straight face all the time. A little bit of sympathy. I think they deserve sympathy. And I used to get these reports done and sent back. I never heard whether they were of any use or whatever happened to them. I can't even remember. There must have been some indication as to who... the unit or the name of a particular Japanese officer who had been involved in these atrocities.
Had there been a lot of this sort of thing going on around Tonga as well?
Oh, yeah, there's a lot. I didn't stay in Tonga. I used to go out, of course, the division was spread over a very large area. Mm. I remember, there were two or three occasions, but I think the Japanese used to haul people in for almost anything, really, locally. Especially those who were out of the supervision of superior officers, just for the fun of it. And I have to say, I remember a cartoon in Soldier magazine, which came out in those days, of a cartoon of a Japanese prisoner of war in the dock being tried. And he's standing there, and he's got his arm crooked with his finger pointing up like that, and he's saying, British soldier, also very brutal, always bashing charpoy. And, of course, the charpoy was the Indian word for bed. And it was a British soldier's way of saying that they were going, bashing charpoy was going to bed. I thought it was rather a good one. The other things I had to do whilst I was there was to go around and visit the brigades. Now, an Indian division is not Indian altogether. In those days, anyway, a 19th Indian division had one Indian brigade, one British brigade, and one Gurkha brigade. I think the field regiment was a British one. I can't remember. I know that the Indian army had its artillery taken away from him after the mutiny, didn't it? And I don't know whether it was ever restored. I know they had anti-tank weapons. Whether the field guns were ever restored for the war.
They might have had mountain batteries as well.
Yes, yeah. But the services were mixed. I mean, there were Indian Royal Army, Royal Indian Army Service Corps, and Rimi were British, I remember. I remember the British were the Worcesters, the Royal Berkshires, and the
Cameron Highlanders.
No, Worcesters, Royal Berks, and Welsh Regiment.
Welsh.
And they were all regulars. They were either 1st or 2nd battalions. The Indian regiments were, I can't right. I know there was a Rajput one, a Rajputana. Wait a minute, I made a note down here, I don't know if I can remember them. Yes, Rajputana rifles. There was a Punjab and a Baluchi. I can't remember their numbers. And then there was the Frontier Force Regiment and an Assam Battalion.
Assam were...
But I don't know what they were doing there. I don't know whether they were just unattached to us or we happened to be nearby. And then, of course, the Gurkhas were Gurkha Rifles. They were the Prince of Wales' own, which was before Edward VII, before he became king. And there was a machine gun battalion, which was Sikh. It was called the divisional badge was one of a dagger, and therefore it became known as the Dagger Division. And I know that they'd taken part in the advance down Burma, and one of the, I think they are probably the most outstanding operation they were involved in was the capture of Mandalay, when they had to call in the RAF to drop 2,000 pound bombs to blast the walls of the fort. Fort Dufferin, wasn't it, there, before they could get in. the other thing, of course, I had to do was to go around and visit brigades. And we had a little Oster aircraft. I think it was L5, I can't remember. One was American, one was British. I think the Oster was the British one. And we had this little aircraft, which was positioned on the Maidan out there. And there was a flight lieutenant from the RAF who flew it, and two ground mechanics, and the windsock, and that was RAF station Tongu. And I used to go off with this guy. Sometimes I went by road, but other times I would go off with him with the aircraft, and we'd just take off, just skim the trees at the end of the Maidan. And then as soon as we got to sort of cruising flight, he'd turn the switch over to George, light a cigarette, turn the radio on, which we get the local sort of forces station, I suppose, and just sit back. And I look out the window and I see a jungle there. And we go for 2 or 3 hours, nothing but jungle underneath. And I don't think it occurred to me at the time. I must have looked at that propeller and wondered, hoped it kept going, because if it didn't, we were finished, because we'd just drop into the jungle somewhere and nobody knew where we were, I don't think. So, anyway, the brigades, as I say, there was one quite close by, and then there was another one, the British one, I think, was close by, because they did some things later which I'll come to. And then we used to land on a sort of very rough sort of area which had cleared for the aircraft to come in, and he would stay there and refuel and so forth whilst I walked into the town and saw who I wanted to see.
What were the brigade actually doing?
Nothing really.
Were they involved in any occupation?
No.
Duties?
No, not really, I don't think. I don't think we were even involved in anti-Dacoit activities at that time. We were later, when I got down to Burma Command.
Yes.
There may have been, but we had to guard, because there was a REOC big ammunition dump about a couple of miles outside Tongu. And some of the locals used to try and get in there to get weapons, and every night you'd hear gunfire from there, so people firing weapons. They say, that's just the dump again, so nobody worried.
Did they manage to get in and get anything?
I don't think so, no. I don't think they were that determined. I mean, they just fired a few rounds, but I mean, they weren't a determined lot, except when, of course, the dacoits in those days was an honourable profession which had been going on for years. It wasn't against the British per se. They merely raided villages and took the women if they wanted them, or money, food, whatever. They were just wild and lived in the jungle, but a lot of them weren't. A lot of them came from the villages themselves. I mean, you see a guy driving a bullock cart down the road with a sort of local cigar in his mouth, looking as if butter wouldn't melt in his mouth, and a law-abiding citizen. At night, he'd go out and join the dacoits and raid another village. They didn't all do it, but I mean, that was the common thing to happen. But we were still rounding up Japanese in the jungle, of course, round the place as well.
I was going to ask you about that. How was that done? Did you have patrols or sweeps going through?
No, we waited until we got information that there were Japanese somewhere and then sent troops out. It usually came from the locals who said they'd seen Japanese here, or Japanese would wander into the village and they say, it's all right, mate, war's over as far as you're concerned, and we went out and brought them in. We never had to fight. There was no fighting at all.
None of them were disposed to resist you?
No, I don't remember any.
What did you do with them when you got them?
Well, there was a cage nearby, not far from us, where they all went into. They hadn't been repatriated yet. They were still in this big cage down the road, which I suppose we had to provide guards for.
What sort of physical condition were they in? Did you?
I can't remember. I only saw the ones which had been in the cage for some time, when they'd been cleaned up and their uniforms were probably part worn, I'd say. But I came across them, of course, later. Well, very soon after I got there, when it was decided that we should do something, and a tattoo was thought of. Now, we had to start from absolute scratch because there was nowhere to hold a tattoo. There was no arena there. So the GSO-1 was called Bruce, who was my boss. I don't remember having very many dealings with him, actually. He was getting on a bit as far as someone who was 25 was concerned. I think he must have been well in his upper 40s. A Gurkha, and he was put in charge. Anyway, his idea or the general's idea that we should have a tattoo, but anyway, he was put in charge, and I always thought he was a bit of an old dry stick. I thought he'd been out there too long and had too much curry and pink gins and that sort of thing, but he turned out to be actually excellent. He had a very good administrative ability. And he was creative as well, because he thought up a lot of the terms and he had to put them through their paces and rehearsals and that sort of thing. So first of all, we got some bulldozers and found an area which we could work on and bulldozed out a big arena. Then the seats round the side, which were all earthen, of course, and flattened round in sort of the Colosseum seats all around.
Terraced.
Terraced, yeah. And then marshalling areas outside, and then we had to have